I guess it's interesting looking back on it, actually, that lack of job security actually gave me a lot of personal security, because I knew that I had a really quick escape route if I needed it, and I guess that's what I needed as a trans person at that time.
When it comes to your career, there isn't one formula for success. And some of the best stories I've heard didn't follow a plan. That's why I've created this podcast. In each episode, I'll share an inspirational career story and introduce you to the amazing person behind it. I'm Steve, and welcome to the My Career Story podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the My Career Story podcast with me, your host, Steve Keith. Now we're on to the final episode of season four, this special season focusing on career stories coming from the LGBTQ plus community. And I have Bobby Pickard with me today. Hello, Bobby. How are you?
I'm really good. Thank you. And thank you for inviting me on.
You're more than welcome. So Bobby was the first openly transgender person in BP and as co-chair of BP Pride's transgender group has transformed trans awareness within the company. She is the founder of Trans in the City, a corporate collaboration of over 250 organisations to further transgender awareness globally. Bobby is a diversity role model and a very proud champion of Stonewall Housing. She was voted number one in the Outstanding 50 LGBT plus Future Leaders List 2019, number four in 2020, and included in PwC's Stonewall 50 Inspirational Role Models 2019, as well as being the winner of the Rainbow Honours LGBTQ plus Champion Award in 2019, the Nestle Diversity Champion Award at the 2020 British LGBT Awards, placing 14th in the Pride Power List 2020 and was a business nominee in the 2021 Diva Awards. There's a lot there for us to talk about, isn't there? She plays the guitar and bass and sings and has two grown-up children and lives in Brighton, UK. Bobby, take us away. What's your career story?
Well, long, I suppose. I started at the middle of the 18th century. No, I started in the mid-90s. So mostly because I was trans, I bombed out of sixth form at the end of my first year. I was going through lots of personal stuff at the time. I ended up getting an apprenticeship with British Aerospace in Kingston. And I did that for, I did a 4-year apprenticeship working on all different types of aircraft. I ended up at the airfield in Guildford working in flight test and flight test avionics, which was brilliant. And we looked after everything, built everything from Harriers to Hawks to doing repairs on loads and loads of different aircraft, Spitfires, everything. It was a really good grounding, I guess, in engineering. And and in those days, there weren't really, this shows how old I am, there weren't really many computers. There were big mainframe computers, but there weren't PCs or anything like that. No network. So I was really lucky to be in avionics just when IT really started. And I worked on some of the first networks, some of the first PCs before Windows was about. And from there, that gave me a chance. I moved on to Kodak from there. So I was Kodak's digital services specialist for the whole of the south of England, looking after all of Kodak's printers, which weren't quite as exciting as aeroplanes, but I started looking after all of their printers and print stations and networks. From there, I got headhunted by Computer Weekly, and I started doing the first website. So I did the first globally load balanced website between the UK and the US. And I looked after loads of different websites. Total Jobs did the first version of Total Jobs, and New Scientist, and Electronics Weekly, and what else was there? It was like Train Spotters Weekly or something. It wasn't called Train Spotters Weekly, but that's what it basically was. Railway Gazette, that's what it was called. So there was all loads of things like that that were really, 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 really interesting. Honestly, they were really boring. From there, I was headhunted again by Enron, which loads of people, I guess, might have heard from loads of bad stories about Enron, about what Enron did. But actually, Enron was a great place to work because they had loads of money. I know it wasn't their money, but they had loads of money to spend. They got loads and loads of really innovative, really clever people that were top of their game. And I guess at the time I was probably top of my game in terms of websites. I was asked to go to Seattle by Microsoft to talk about the new design of their web server. So I guess I was a real propeller head in those days. And it was great. We did some really amazing, innovative stuff at Enron. And we actually ran the world's most profitable websites, in trading websites. And really from there, the Enron thing was the thing that I got headhunted again. Went to BP and ran BP's server trading infrastructure for them. So I was the manager of the server team, trading team for the trading arm. And that was great. I had a team of 25 people that were just really fabulous. And I still meet them these days. They're some of my best friends. We got on so well, and we were very disruptive in what we did. And I think that's something that I really take with me and value as in business and in life now, really. I base a lot of what I do in trans awareness around disruption.
Yeah.
After BP, I got asked to run BNP Paribas' global Windows infrastructure. So I did that for a little while. I looked after Windows infrastructure, both desktops and servers around the world, apart from France, because they had to have somebody that was French that ran French infrastructure. But I did that for a few years and then started my own computer consultancy. Did that for 10 years. Came out as trans at BP while I was there as a consultant, and they were absolutely amazing and let me run riot with trans awareness in BP and throw a huge rock into the sort of tranquil waters that were BP's, I suppose, D&I values and everything at the time. And really, you know, that trans awareness that they let me do. I mean, they let me literally do anything I wanted around trans awareness, so I did. I really took the mickey, really. But it was fabulous. You know, we had we really changed, I think, not only BP's awareness of what trans and non-binary is, but I think we really gave BP a good shake-up in terms of diversity and inclusion and what people could talk about. I mean, I was doing this in my own time, really. At the time, I was still a program manager in IT, so I was doing loads of boring stuff. And then by the time I finished that, I used to go off and do trans awareness stuff, which is far more interesting. But it, you know, I think when you have somebody that stands on the main stage in the head office in front of all the top execs and the CEO and starts talking about penises and vaginas, it gives a big shake-up to an organization. And it means, you know, that people in BP all of a sudden lost that taboo about talking about transgender, but they lost it about talking about menopause and mental well-being and how they were feeling and hidden diversities and all of those sort of things as well. So that was really fabulous. And then BP offered me a permanent role in diversity and inclusion last year. And I was a bit worried about becoming permanent again, because I'd run my own business for 10 years. I was very happy running my own business. And I actually felt quite protected as a trans person running my own business, because it gives you a level of independence where, you know, if you do get into that situation, you can just turn around and go, you know what, I'll see you later. I'm going to work somebody else, somewhere else. But, you know, I'd worked with BP for a long time, lots of years. I knew they were inclusive, and I absolutely knew they supported me as a trans person. So I went for it. I took the leap and became a permie again. And I've loved every minute of it. They've, you know, it's really fabulous, not only doing trans awareness, but doing all forms of diversity. And BP's actually been on such a journey around diversity that now they get it. You know, it's really in the heart of what they do. And I think they've turned into a much more empathic organization. And that's, and it's been really lovely to be on that journey.
Fantastic. So you gave me your book title for your career story, and it was "Wow, She Did a Lot." So that makes sense, having heard your story there.
Sure.
If I can go back to that time where you were working for yourself, so I work for myself as well, and I can resonate on some level in terms of the independence and kind of being able to work for yourself and how empowering that can be. What were some of the highs and the lows of working for yourself, maybe?
I mean, I guess the real high of working for myself is I worked for a really good boss that really understood trans awareness because it was me. I didn't have to worry about what people would think about me. I was very, I've been really privileged in my career. Some of it's been down to hard work, but lots of it's been down to privilege. And I've been in the situation where I've been able to be top of my game for lots and lots of years. And I think working for myself was great for me. I think the privilege that allowed me to become good at what I do and top at what I do, I was going to say was, but I guess I still am a good project and program manager. And that means I could more or less pick and choose where I wanted to go to. And being self-employed meant I had that freedom as well. You know, it's lots of people, I think, see job security as a major benefit. I did have some bad experiences from when people guessed I was trans earlier on in my career. And actually that job security, where you have to give 3 months notice and all of the rest of the stuff, was really detrimental to me. So I liked living on the edge a bit, I guess, with being self-employed and knowing that if I found myself in a situation that was really uncomfortable for me, I could give a week's notice and be somewhere. I could choose somewhere else to go and you know, somewhere safer. So actually, you know, it's I guess it's interesting looking back on it, actually, that lack of job security actually gave me a lot of personal security. Because I knew that I had a really quick escape route if I needed it, and I guess that's what I needed as a trans person at that time. Mm. It's I think if you are running your own business, you can put into it what you want to put into it, and you know, I think almost everybody I know that runs their own business, their own consultancy goes into it because it's something they're good at and they like doing. And those two combinations are, you know, that's a really strong combination for success, because that's what builds confidence in somebody. And if you've got confidence in your own abilities, then that comes across and you get to the stage where you feel like you can do good things and get on and do good things. And I guess that's where I was at, you know. I was privileged not to be out of work all the way through the financial crisis, and all the way through. I think the longest I didn't have a contract was I think 7 days, I think. I think I did a good job. I think I did a good job of that. So.
Yeah, it sounds like you did. And that is really interesting hearing you talk about it there in terms of your own, you know, personal safety, and that kind of the way that your people talk about job security is it being kind of like a safer option. If you're happy to share, what have been some of your experiences in the workplace where you haven't felt safe as a transgender woman?
Yeah, it's you know, it's being safe as a transgender woman is very subjective, actually, especially in today's society, because there's not a week that goes by that I don't receive a load of abuse. I mean, mostly online these days, you know. I'm privileged enough to fit into what society thinks a trans woman should look like, which is pretty ridiculous, actually. You know, it doesn't make me, just because I kind of fit into something that society doesn't find offensive, doesn't make me any better a trans person than anybody else. And I think in lots of cases, I think it makes me a less better trans person, actually, because I'm lucky enough not to receive abuse in the street when I know lots of my friends do. And it's and I think that's hideous and actually very unfair, and in lots of ways I feel quite guilty about that. But so being safe as a trans person is subjective. There was times in one of the employers I worked for, my manager wasn't the nicest chap in the world anyway. In the sort of early to mid 2000s, before the financial crisis, I think companies were a lot more bullish. They were a lot more straight, white, male, dominated, very testosterone-y as well. And my manager definitely fitted that demographic. I came very close to coming out in the middle of the 2000s, extremely close to coming out. And he guessed. I mean, I think lots of people guessed. Lots of my friends knew anyway, you know, like loads of trans people, my coming out, like sorry, LGBTQIA people, you know, my coming out story stretches back decades. But I wasn't out at work, and my manager guessed that I was out of work, and he made my life hell. He used to drop horrible little bits, lots of bits of hate into conversations. I mean, you know, he was clever at it. He used to just like snidey little comments here and there. He started setting me up in conversations, in meetings, to make me look stupid. So we'd have a conversation before a meeting about, I don't know, it could be about anything, about how we were going to approach support in some country or whatever like that. And we'd agree on an approach. And in lots of cases, I wouldn't agree with the approach, but he'd sort of say, no, this is what we're going to do. and then go to the meeting. And then he used to ask me the approach, and I'd say the agreed approach, and he'd say, well, I think that's a stupid way of doing things. You know, we shouldn't do that. So he used to do all of that undermining. And he told all of his mates about me, so they started doing the same sort of thing as well. So it was a really, started turning into a really unpleasant environment, to the point where actually I had a diary, you know, page per day diary that I used to write down everything that was happening. I went off on holiday. I had a team of 40 people, 40 permanent people, and about a team of another 80 or so contractors that were working all around the world. Went off on holiday, came back from holiday after 2 weeks, and found out he'd given my team to one of his friends, and he'd left me with a team of two people. So I went to HR and basically arranged redundancy and left from that point. But it was a very, very stressful and horrible time in my life, actually. Mm. And really, I guess that's kind of what ended my permanent career, really. I think I had quite a good permanent career. You know, I was very young, really, when I became like a propeller head and a manager and all of that. So, you know, it's something that I don't think about a lot, actually, because I don't regrets. I've spent a lot of my life expecting not to be here, frankly. And that means I don't regret things that have happened, because, you know, I'm always quite surprised that I'm still here. So and actually very pleased that I'm here these days. But I do wonder where I'd be with my career, mm-hmm. if that hadn't have happened. But then, you know, saying that, I had a really fabulous career being self-employed, and you know, I might not have ended up where I am now, which is really, really happy. So,
Great. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you for sharing that as well.
Pleasure.
So, now that you've moved back into permanent employment and you're with BP, which obviously sounds like a great place to work,
absolutely,
and to be yourself, yep, what are some of the differences that you've seen? Like, what's the positive experience of being in a place that accepts you for who you are?
There's so many positives. I mean, you know, I started my transition as a contractor in BP, and they were so not only accepting, but so actively supportive. You know, I had people going out of their way to make sure I was okay. I had people stopping me in the corridor, you know, giving me hugs. There was a Pride chocolate bar that came out. I can't remember what it was, but it was a chocolate bar with a Pride flag on it, and somebody that I'd only, like, you know, just given one of my courses to, I didn't really know, went to the canteen and then walked halfway across site just to give me a Pride chocolate bar, things like that. You know, I mean, BP's got as far to go, maybe not as far to go, but, you know, still has a long way to go to become a properly diverse and equitable company. But I guess, one of the most amazing things that's happened there, one of the things where I kind of thought they get it, is I was working my new team, and we were working on gender balance. So we were looking at how many, they were looking at how many men and how many women, mm-hmm, we should aim for by 2030, and it's something we're putting a lot of work into. And I kind of mentioned that, you know, you do appreciate that gender isn't binary, you know, like, hello, you know, we've had these conversations for 3 years. Gender isn't binary. Why are we looking at gender balance in terms of male and female, when we know that there's non-binary people gender non-conforming people in the middle. So why aren't we including those? And we had a conversation, which was kind of what I'd expect, with like lots of people kind of saying like, oh, well, yeah, but you know, it's hard enough doing it for men and women, so maybe we should stick to that, and just do that as a first step and move on from there. And every single one of my team, because in situations like that, then I'm just more likely to go, okay, fine, I appreciate that, we'll work on it going forward. But every single one of my team stood up for me at that point and said, no, we're not going to be doing it as male or female. We need to look at it wider, you know. And that was special, because I knew that people finally got it, at least in the DE&I team, you know. But it was so special as well, because it was, I think, the first time that it hasn't been me standing up as a lone voice or dragging people along, to say, you know, trans and non-binary and gender non-conforming people are valid. You know, we need to include these people in our thinking. And it was the first time that I'd actually heard other voices speak up that weren't mine. And it was so special. It's an amazing, wonderful team to work in. We are all, there's five of us, and we all have our diversity specialisms, you know, but we're all a bunch of troublemakers. We're all real disruptors, and we're all people that just won't accept bland statements, you know, of, oh, that's too difficult, or no, we couldn't do that, or no, we don't really know how to do that.
Yeah.
And I think that's wonderful. You know, I think that creates such an atmosphere where things can be done, and things can be changed, more importantly. And I think that also generates like such openness to talk about things that people are uncomfortable talking about, because, you know, because when you do get a disruptor that's open to talking, then they'll talk about it whether people want to listen or not. And I think that's so, so important, especially around LGBTQIA, but also around, you know, other hidden disabilities, like, you know, mental well-being or neurodiversities or some physical disabilities. And actually, you know, it's even important around race, because, you know, I think so many people think that race as a diversity is done and dusted, you know, but it's absolutely not. It's nowhere near. And actually, you know, that having that, those people that are disruptors that can talk about their experiences are so important for whatever diversity.
I completely agree. I've been reading Matthew Syed's, maybe not his latest book, you know, but Rebel Ideas, and there's a piece in that around cognitive diversity, and loads of the examples in there of kind of how when you've got a homogenous group that are thinking and look exactly the same, it's not a surprise that you end up making mistakes and not including people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and it's, I mean, there's that side of it, which is hugely important. And that just, you know, that just recycles thought and processes, and you just end up with a stale company and a stale state of affairs. But you know, the opposite of that is what companies should be really aiming for. And that's, you know, if you do get diversity of thought, then you end up with greater innovation, you end up with better problem solving, you end up with better decision making, you end up with a happier workforce, and all of those things create better teams. And then all of those things create more profit, because your company's better at doing what it needs to do. So, you know, you know, if there are business leaders on here that don't get why diversity and inclusion and including every single person isn't a good thing, then either get with it and understand why, or prepare to lose your company in 15 years because the younger generation that we're hoping to attract as our future employees do get it. And they're definitely looking for places that get it as well as a good place to work.
Yeah, no, they are. And that, I think it goes across all of the different kind of characteristics that companies might focus on or may not focus on when they're looking at their strategies. And going back to what you were saying about undisclosed characteristics as well, it's always been something that frustrates me in big volume recruitment processes, is that where somebody is happy, either he's happy to share or there isn't an option there, so kind of can't share. And that comes back to the non-binary element of gender, whether or not somebody's happy sharing a disability. So I've been doing some reading over the weekend around disability pride and then the flag and the symbolism behind it for this month. And when you look at that, you break that down into, I'm just going to refer so I don't forget it, is kind of that can break down into the mental illness side of disability, the cognitive side, the sensory side, the physical side, inaccessibility, undisclosed and invisible.
Absolutely.
And companies need to get better at having conversations about all of these things and getting comfortable with being uncomfortable.
They absolutely do. And the thing that's aside from the fact that it's I think such a cool flag, I really love it. It's just awesome. It's so interesting, especially coming from like an IT background, that actually, some of the things that we really prize and look for as big organizations in our IT people are exactly the type of attributes you get in neurodiverse people. But the way we recruit those people that we want to get into our company is by assuming that everybody's extroverted, everybody likes noise, everybody likes bright environments, vibrant colors, all of that thing, because IT's funky and IT's like forward thinking, and everybody has to be really massively on board with the standing up and talking about what you're doing and jumping up and down and shouting about stuff. But actually, all of those things that we really need these days around big data, around pattern matching, around being able to spot errors in loads of code, are exactly what you find in the neurodiverse community. And there's no way on earth we'd be able to get them into the positions where they would be so valued in our organizations with existing interview techniques. So, and that's one of the things that we've been looking at recently, and I know lots of other big tech companies have been as well, because these are the people that have amazing skill sets, so valuable, and actually we shouldn't be expecting them to change to come and work for us. We should be changing what we're doing so they feel that they can come and work for us and give us their skills, because it's so massively overlooked in industry, and it really needs to be resolved. And same thing, physical disabilities. There's so many areas of physical disability that prevent people with fabulous, valuable skill sets from being able to use them and to flourish in their careers. I mean, what the hell is that about, honestly, for something that's just, just takes a bit of time and maybe some expense and a bit of effort, you could just end up with a workforce that's so more effective, and a company that's just so more profitable and innovative and effective,
Yeah, you could. But and I'm not using this as a justification. I would also say that the time, the expense and effort is what puts people off and means that it doesn't happen, and that it becomes a way of justifying and a reason for not focusing on it.
It is. And that it's the worst justification in the world, because if you could say, so companies that are diverse are 20 to 25% more profitable than those that aren't. Yeah. So if you could go along to any boss of any company and say, I can give you something that will give you 20% more profit this year for next to no effort, really. You know, how much does a ramp cost? How much does having a quiet room or letting somebody work from home these days honestly cost? Peanuts. 20% more profitability for that. It's the worst justification in the world, saying it will take time and money to make places more inclusive for people. It's complete. It's completely counterproductive in terms of where a business needs to be.
Yes. So tell us more about the work that you've been doing with Trans in the City, because I know some of the things that you've been doing, but I think there's a nice crossover point there of what businesses can be doing for the trans community. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so Trans in the City started out of the trans awareness training that I started doing for BP. I convinced BP to let me start training external companies. And BP at the time were very risk averse and conservative. So that was a big thing that they allowed me to do. I'm not sure I would have taken no for an answer, to be honest. But anyway, so I got five other companies, did some training for five other companies, and became friends with people that work there, and convinced those five companies that we should run a joint event. This was 2018. So we did a joint event in Canary Wharf. And at the time, I think we had about, I can't remember how many people we had. I think it was about 100 and something people turn up. And I think at the time it was the biggest corporate collaboration for a transgender awareness event at the time. And that was great, you know, because one of the things I wanted to do, I'd seen those organizations that had trans role models almost getting into a kind of arms race about trans awareness, where they'd just try and do a great event, which was brilliant. But they used to use it as almost a competition to, you know, look how great we are on trans awareness. And so the next one that happened to have a trans role model would try and do the same. And that's not what trans awareness needs. What trans awareness needs is people to start collaborating, working together, sharing role models and information and education, because that's what trans people need. You know, trans awareness in this country is extremely low. Nobody really understands about transgender, that it's perfectly natural. It's a hormonal development that happens during the womb, sometimes during puberty. And, you know, that vacuum just allows all of the anti-trans media, which is just about all of them, and anti-trans groups to feed into that vacuum whatever misdirection and lies that they want. Mm-hmm. So I got this group of five together to start collaborating, and that went really well. So I decided to put a bit more effort in. So the next year we had the top of Canary Wharf Tower, 65 companies and 400 people. And we raised, I think, £30,000 for mermaids. And I thought that was quite good, but I thought we could still do better. So last year we had, obviously we were online last year. Last year I was going to hire out the Winter Garden in Canary Wharf and have 1,400 people attend and have a day of different training courses. And by that time we'd reached 250 companies, and we'd raised, I think, £107,000 or so for mermaids last year, and lots of money for other charities, LGBTQ charities as well, which is okay, but it's still not good enough, really, is it? You know, we're up to 360 charities. We did lots of action around Gender Recognition Act last year, where we got 170 of those companies to write publicly to the government opposing their implied changes. We've done, we've had companies make statements about some of the legislation that's happening in the States. We've had them speak out about some of the situation that's happening in Hungary. And really, you know, what Trans in the City is about now, and we're up to, we did Trans Rights at humanrights.co.uk as well, to let some of our companies, you know, visibly show their support for trans people. You know, we're up to 360 something companies now. And the whole point of Trans in the City is to try and raise trans awareness in those organizations, not just to raise the awareness of their employees, because that will help trans awareness in society, but it's also to raise the confidence in those organizations that speaking out positively about trans and non-binary and gender non-conforming people, and about people with all diversities, actually is a good thing to do and is something that's not detrimental for their business. And also to give them that confidence to be able to say to other businesses and actually the government, you know, we're heading in this direction in diversity and inclusion. Trans people and non-binary people and gender non-conforming people are absolutely key to our diversity in our companies and are valued and valuable. And, you know, we see no problem at all in having them in our company. So, you know, the government and some other companies are either in the doldrums or, in the case of the government, seem to be heading off in a completely strange direction. And we do need those business voices, those business allies, actually, especially senior business allies, because it's very useful to have senior business people going and talking to senior people in other businesses and governments and saying, there isn't a problem. Whatever you're listening to is not the truth, not the right way to go. You know, we can help you and we can show you how it's a really positive thing. And that's, you know, also what we try and do. It's very difficult with the UK government getting any sort of engagement at the moment. The All-Party Parliamentary Group for LGBT Rights Globally are a fantastic group of people, but they're massively underfunded, surprise, surprise, you know, hugely overworked. Whereas, you know, we've seen some of the ministers, especially the Women's and Equalities Minister and the Equalities Minister, with an actively anti-trans viewpoint and direction they want to take things in. And actually almost, you know, it's kind of evolving actually into almost an anti-diversity viewpoint, which I think is quite strange for an equalities office. To give you an example, you know, I've done work this year. You know, we had to cancel Trans in the City event this year, but we did it online. So we did 37 awareness sessions in Trans Awareness Week from different companies and raised loads of money for different charities. And that was good, actually. You know, I started off at the beginning of the year thinking it's a really negative thing, but actually all of those sessions have turned from being very London or site focused to being global. And, you know, I've done talks and training this year across the world. I've done it in, I did one day where I started at 2 a.m. in Australia and followed the sun across Singapore and India and the Middle East and Africa and then Europe and the UK, and I finished off in California. I've done training in Mexico. I had an amazing session with the Argentinian government, talking to their Undersecretary for Diversity, Women and Gender Equality, And I can absolutely say to the UK government that for their Safe to Be Me conference that they're running with Argentina next year, I think probably the best thing for the UK government to do is just sit down in your seat and just be quiet and listen to the Argentinians. But they're so far ahead. It's both wonderful and really disappointing to see. I'm incredibly privileged to be in the position that I can do these things, and I damn well am going to make the most of that privilege and make sure that people understand that there's a whole group of trans and non-binary and gender non-conforming people that don't have that privilege, you know. And, you know, that's not just trans women, that's, you know, trans people of colour, Indigenous trans people, you know, non-binary people with different diversities, different intersectionalities, you know. We either all succeed or none of us succeed. And that's, I guess, kind of why I flog myself to death working on it, really. And I do, because it's, you know, if I'm given the opportunity and the privilege to be able to do these things, then I kind of feel that's a weight that I have to carry. I have to make impact for people that aren't, and that's I do. I mean, last year it was 14-hour days, 7 days a week. This year I'm taking it a little bit more easy, but I won't stop until absolutely every trans person's able to get a gender recognition certificate, or better still, can just self-ID. I won't stop until every single company knows about trans people and non-binary people and respects them and values them. And I won't stop until every single trans, non-binary and gender non-conforming person doesn't have to take the road that I took through my life.
Good for you. And that speaks really strongly to the three words that you gave me to describe your story as well, there, of never stopping ever.
Thank you.
I'm going to let you go in a second, Bobby, but what would be the one piece of career advice that you would give the listeners today?
Just keep swimming is my mantra for life, actually, and it definitely works for careers as well. You know, there's lots of times, no matter what career you get into, no matter what company, how good it is, you know, there will always be times when you come across something hard that you have to do, you know, something that's a really tough time in your life or a tough time in your career. And just keep swimming is so important. You know, whatever you do, just keep doing what you think is right, because if you stick to what you think is right, then the outcome will be right for you. And I guess, you know, never stop learning. Never stop. I think whenever you stop learning is the time that you lose the spark for what you're doing. I think all the time that you learn new things, you're open enough to receive new things. That's the thing that makes your career fun and enjoyable, and you're able to see more opportunities, because you never know, you might learn something today that gives you the spark to go off and do something completely different, you know. And I've done that a few times in my career now, and there's absolutely nothing like it, actually. It's really good fun. It's one of those like leap of faith things that's you know, I guess you do have to have a little bit of confidence in yourself. But actually, you know, I don't think anything builds confidence like taking a leap of faith, because I can almost guarantee you will come out okay after that leap of faith. So, and that will just build your confidence. But no, keep on swimming, keep going, and keep learning.
Wonderful. Bobby, thank you so much for spending some time with me today for the episode. It's been really great to hear more about your story and to talk to you about some really important things.
Thanks, Steve. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you to you, for joining us today. So that's the end of the final episode of the fourth season. The fifth season will be coming in the autumn. We're going to be focusing on founders and freelancers. So there'll be more to come about that later on in the year. Thanks again to you, Bobby. And I will be speaking to everybody later on in the year. Bye for now.